Hello and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Each week, Inside Education brings you the best from the world of education from an Irish perspective. My name is Sean Delaney and you can listen to or download hundreds of podcasts of previous editions of Inside Education from seandelaney.com/podcasts. On this week's programme, I bring you an interview with an American psychologist who studies education and who is especially keen on large-scale research. Professor Bob Slaven directs the Centre for Research and Reform in Education at Johns Hopkins University, and he chairs the Success for All Foundation. He is particularly interested in topics such as ability grouping, school and classroom organisation, cooperative learning, and evidence-based reform. I met up with Bob at the recent annual conference of the American Education Research Association. I began our conversation by asking him to tell me what cooperative learning is.
Cooperative learning refers to a whole set of different approaches in which children work together in small groups where they have a responsibility to try to make sure that not only they but also their group mates are learning the material that the teacher has introduced, or they may be doing reports, they may be doing projects. It may be that the teacher has taught a lesson and the students are helping each other to master that lesson. Quite different applications of the idea, but what binds all of those together is the notion that children are working in groups, usually groups of four or thereabouts, to help each other learn.
What is the youngest children can be when they start working on cooperative learning?
There are forms of cooperative learning that go down to preschool. Usually the typical forms of cooperative learning, though, are much more common starting second or third grade.
The reason I ask you about the age is because I thought it might be difficult for children to think about taking responsibility for each other's learning.
Right.
That seems quite demanding. Is that something they have to learn?
So the more sophisticated forms of cooperative learning, of course, are going to be used with somewhat older children. But very young children can work in pairs, for example. They can take turns. They can do things as a small group with less structure and less focus on making sure that others are learning, but rather, you know, something emerges from the cooperative activity itself.
And is there much need for teacher input when children are working on cooperative learning?
It depends what the form of cooperative learning is and what the learning objective is. So, for example, typically teachers would teach something at the beginning to bring information or to engage or excite students about a given topic before the students begin working in their groups. And then while the students are working in their groups, the teacher might be circulating among the groups and clarifying, listening in to see what the groups are talking about, to see if they're on track, looking for individual students who the teacher may know are likely to struggle with the content or to have difficulty with the team. So they may, you know, be trying to problem solve as the groups are working with each other. And teachers may alternate between whole class activities and team activities or group activities, either as part of an original plan, or it may be that as the teacher circulates among the groups, the teacher may find out that the groups are headed in completely the wrong direction and may call them all back together to say, no, you know, that's not what I meant, and, you know, to get them back on track. Then there are some circumstances, for example, in project-based learning where the teacher may decide explicitly to stay out of the way, to do less of the intervening and let the students make their own mistakes and come to their own conclusions. Again, it all depends on what the purpose of instruction is.
Can you give an example of any of the kinds of tasks that you've seen teachers giving children to work on cooperatively?
It varies so widely. Some of them are teaching at one end of a continuum, if you will, might be teaching a traditional mathematics objective. So the teacher may teach something about place values in decimals, right? And then after having taught it, may give some exercises. The students work together, try to make sure that everybody understands what's going on. Then students put everything away, they take a quiz, and the success of their group at getting everyone to learn that activity and be able to succeed at it is what makes them successful as a total group. And they may get some recognition or cheers or something like that based on doing that. So that's a situation where the objective is very clear. Traditional teaching is going to happen at the front end. The team activity is replacing some individual practice that the kids might have done, but otherwise it's a fairly traditional lesson. At the other end, you might imagine a situation in which the students are writing compositions or writing biographies of people who were important in, women's suffrage around the world. And so each group might choose a different woman to write about. They might then, on their own, decide how to divide up the task. I'm going to focus on the woman's early childhood and background, and I'm going to focus on, another child is going to focus on their main accomplishments. And they maybe have chapters of a report. Each chapter might have a chapter author, but at the same time, the other students have read each other's chapters and they're all responding to each other and helping each other to improve the quality of the of their chapters, but also to make sure that they all fit together properly and that the whole of the thing is of high quality. So that's a situation in which there's much more autonomy on the part of the students and there's much more possibility for creativity, and not every class or group is going to do the same thing, and that's fine. So and many, many other variations that you might imagine between those two endpoints.
And does the teacher need to explicitly teach how to work as a cooperative group, or is it something that children pick up from doing it?
I think teachers always should and usually do teach something about how to work effectively as a group. And then they reinforce that over a period of time. In all of our cooperative learning methods, we have cooperative standards. There are cooperative skills such as active listening. You know, we teach kids specifically how, you know, to nod as the speaker is speaking, you know, how to disagree with dignity. You know, how to come to a satisfactory resolution when you have a disagreement, how to do a good job of tutoring somebody and how to help somebody who's struggling with the content, and, you know, a number of other skills that are not only taught, but they're modeled. We have videos that show children what they look like when it's going well, and the children may then do simulations where during a training period they're learning how to use those kinds of skills, things of that kind to make quite clear what we mean by effective working in a group. And then after that, the teacher is going to the different groups and saying, hey, I love the way you're including everyone. I love the way you're showing that you're listening and restating what the speaker said, you know, whatever the skills might be to communicate to the students where when they're moving toward a goal of effective use of the cooperative learning opportunity.
And for a teacher who is not currently using cooperative learning, how would you make a case to them for the benefits of cooperative learning?
Well, first off, there's a massive amount of research that shows that properly used, cooperative learning is beneficial for children's learning, and that is true for high achievers, for average achievers, and for low achievers. Secondly, cooperative learning is very engaging. You know, the children themselves usually love it. They feel more activated. They feel more, excited about the topic. And I think anybody can see why, if you are excited about something and engaged with it, that you're more likely to learn a lot from it. And I think it's easy to communicate to teachers, when they think back to their own learning, they can usually think of situations in which they worked as a team or worked as a group, and that they still remember much more from that activity than they do from things when they were sitting in rows and doing worksheets and that sort of traditional thing. In fact, something that's been known for hundreds of years is that you learn by teaching. You know, that teachers notice that they learn a lot more about a subject because they teach it, and in a sense, you're giving students regular opportunities to take advantage of that phenomenon. They're not always teaching each other, but just the fact of explaining your current understanding of something to another person is very powerful as a learning method because you have to organize it in your mind to in order to explain it and then get feedback on it from the other person. And, you know, that's a much more powerful means of learning something than just hearing it from a teacher and not doing that kind of processing.
You prefaced your list of benefits of cooperative learning by saying, when properly used. What can go wrong with what people might suppose is cooperative learning?
There are two big things that go wrong with cooperative learning, and I wish everybody understood that that was the case, because I see people unaware of these problems and then suffering from them. One of them is called the free rider problem, and the free rider problem is where one or two students in a group are doing all the work and everybody else is just watching them do it. So it's easy to be lazy and let other people do it. That's why in our forms of cooperative learning, the success of the group is always dependent on the success of individuals. So you add together that success. That's why everybody has to have their own chapter of that report, for example, so that it says that Dylan did this one, this part, even though Dylan had help, and Dylan helped Mary do this other part. You know, they did it as a team, but there are still portions that can be traced to them personally, and so that they feel a personal responsibility. And that's just to keep it from a situation in which, one person does it and the others watch. The other closely associated problem is the bully. There may be a student or two who feel like they're God's gift to the school system, and they may not want the other children to participate. So they may kind of put them down and just tell them to be quiet while they are doing the very important work. You know, the solution to that is the same, where, you know, if you focus on the success of the group being the success of individuals, the teacher can come by and say, listen, you may have this, but if your teammates do not, your team cannot win. Your team cannot succeed unless everybody's got it. So you have to involve them. If they want to participate, you want to know where their thinking is, both to build their allegiance to the group and their involvement with the group, and also to be sure that they've got the content as well.
What are the implications for assessment? Do you generally think of assessing groups, or do you go back to individual assessment, after doing some work on cooperative learning?
The assessment should always be individual. Learning does not exist in a group. It exists in the heads of individuals. So the purpose of the group is to help build learning in the heads of each person who participated. If you allow for the whole group to be assessed in terms of learning, of course you have the problem that you may be assessing one student who does in fact understand perfectly, but three students are not necessary to the group's product. So in order to be sure that each group member's learning is essential and to get to the outcome, which is learning for every person in the group, you've got to assess the individuals to be sure that everybody has benefited from this activity.
Are there some children who take to cooperative learning very well and some maybe who find it difficult or don't take to it so well?
Certainly there are students who find cooperative learning very easy and compatible with the way they are, and others who find it more difficult. Students who are more outgoing and social and so on, of course, cooperative learning makes perfect sense to them. And so others who might be shy or more reticent or, not so confident in their skills might want to hang back. They may feel that they don't want to expose themselves to teasing or something because they don't know, and they're always very quiet in class, so nobody will know that they don't know. And then on the other side, sometimes there are very high-achieving students who, don't want to deal with all this rubbish and don't want to have to worry about the achievement of everyone else, and they prefer not to work in groups, even though they probably could. But they're not as excited about it. And I think that in our view, nobody's going to use cooperative learning all the time, every day, but it's a very important skill to have. So if you are reticent and quiet in class and so on, it's not a terrible thing to bring you out and to, give you more opportunities to be involved and to express your viewpoint and to help others and that sort of thing. And if you're a high achiever, you may be helpful to learn how to get along with others and to teach others and to, you have something special to contribute to the group But you ought to see it that way rather than something special that you're only contributing to yourself.
And are there some subjects that it works better in than others?
The research says that cooperative learning works in just about any subject at all. It's hard to think of one where it couldn't be adapted for use. And I mean, there are studies in physical education, in music, in just about anything you can possibly imagine that have found that cooperative learning can be very beneficial. I mean, beyond the obvious, which is, you know, reading and math and science. There do have to be adaptations. Even within a course, there are adaptations. So, for example, if you're in an English course, you would obviously do something different if you're learning grammar than if you're learning creative writing. I mean, those are two different tasks, and the way you would organize cooperative learning would be quite different for those objectives. Or if you're studying poetry, or if you're studying, you're reading novels, each of those would have an appropriate way of using cooperative learning, but it would be different from the way you use it for the other parts within that same course.
When you're researching cooperative learning yourself, do you work with local schools, or how do you go about it?
We've done our research all over the U.S., also in other countries. You even did a project in Northern Ireland. You know, it's just wherever we find schools that are eager to participate in a particular research project. But it's not certainly not just limited to our own physical area.
And to make it more concrete for teachers, can you give maybe any other examples that you can think of that stood out for you as being, you know, really good examples of cooperative learning in action?
You mean in particular locations?
Just in general, ones that you kind of say, I think that was a really good use of cooperative learning.
I think in some ways the simplest are sometimes the very best. One of the things that I think is especially beneficial and that makes me particularly excited is where you're working in very low-achieving, very disadvantaged places, and you see kids who have experienced a lot of failure, kids who feel as though school is not really for them, and you see them starting to get really excited. I remember years ago, we were doing a big study of mathematics teaching using cooperative learning in Philadelphia, very high poverty schools in Philadelphia. And these were the worst of the worst of the worst of these schools. We were working with ninth graders. Most ninth graders in Philadelphia they're not dropped out yet, but they're headed there. They're very demotivated. And these were the lowest achieving of those students, meaning that they were the ones who were taking the lowest level mathematics course. So I went to see the various classes that were participating, and one of them happened to be in a very high crime area, North Philadelphia. I'm walking into the school, there's broken glass all over the street. There are cars that have been smashed out on the street. It's just horrible. I go in the school, and the lights have been punched out by the kids, so it's dark. There are suspended ceilings that have been punched out, just as horrible as you can possibly imagine. I go down the hall and turn into the class that I'm looking for, kind of groping in the dark. Turn into the class I'm going for, and there is an oasis of excitement, of, you know, kids so eager to learn math. The teacher was very gifted, no question, but they were having the opportunity to work together, to teach each other. They were just full of energy and enthusiasm about math, something that they were in that class because they were not good at math. That's how they got there. So the bell rings, it's time to go into the next class, and they won't go. They're so excited, they haven't finished yet. You know, there's still more they need to do. So, you know, there was nothing particularly fancy about that particular method. It was something that we've used all over the world. But it was done with real verve on the part of the teacher and skill in a situation where you had kids for whom education had just been, you know, painful for a very long time. And here, from space almost, comes an opportunity to see it all in a very different way.
You mentioned you were in Northern Ireland. How did you come to be working there?
I worked for, I guess, about 8 years at the University of York in England. And what was happening is that Queen's University Belfast was working with these schools, and for some reason they needed somebody to come and take on the project. So we kind of got into it, you know, without having started it from scratch. So there was a nonprofit organization that was involved with a cooperative learning program particularly focused on building social emotional skills. And so that's how we got to be working in Northern Ireland. Gave me a bit of opportunity to visit in Republic of Ireland as well, but we never had any projects there.
You didn't get to any schools?
No, not in Republic of Ireland.
Okay. One of the areas that you're very interested in research is the whole topic of school and classroom organization.
Yeah.
What lessons have you learned about classroom organization, say, first of all, that makes a difference on children's learning?
One thing that we focused on has been on dealing with diversity. And a lot of classroom organization really is on that topic from a variety of directions. One of the things that we were trying to do from the beginning in cooperative learning was to find a way to manage heterogeneity more effectively. You know, if you have kids who are, their skills are below the level of the class, you have kids whose skills are above the level of the class, what do you do with them? You know, many teachers say, well, obviously you're going to have to teach something different to the low kids, the middle kids, the high kids, and they've done grouping within the class, or they do streaming or setting between classes, or, you know, lots of solutions that people try on the basis that something has to be done because the low kids need additional help and the high kids need to be able to go further. And so one aspect of classroom organization, not the only one, but, you know, is cooperative learning itself, is, you know, how do you structure it in such a way to enable you to serve a very broad span of kids? So we've experimented with a number of strategies that add to the cooperative learning ways to accommodate instruction to the needs of kids who are either above or below the class average, but without separating them out. I think that's part of the problem, is that if you take the problem of performance level too seriously and you get carried away with it, you create a sort of a low performing ghetto of kids that are, you know, all together because they have problems, and then they look at each other and say, well, I must be a not very good category of students. And others who feel that they're very privileged and, you know, everything is very cool, and they only have responsibility to themselves. If that were necessary for improving the achievement of all the kids, you might still have a fight about it, but the evidence is clear that it's not necessary. But you do have to do something to accommodate heterogeneity. But the way in which it can be done is to try to maintain heterogeneous placement, avoid streaming or setting as long as you possibly can, but deal with individual differences more flexibly, to provide kids individual help or additional assistance. And now with, you know, computer, you can extend lessons upward and provide additional assistance more easily than was once possible. So all of that can be very, helpful ways to deal with the fundamental problem that classroom organization usually deals with, which is the problem of heterogeneity.
And why is it a problem to stream children according to ability or to put them into groups according to ability?
I think there are two big problems with grouping. One of them is the one I just mentioned, which is the problem that when you create homogeneous groups for instruction, it's homogeneous for every purpose. It's not just for instruction. And you often have kids who are looking around and saying, oh, well, if I'm in this class, then the teacher has very low expectations for me. I have low expectations for myself. You know, maybe I'm headed for a future that's not as bright as my mates are headed for. If you're going to group, you'd better have a mighty good reason for it and good evidence that it's really beneficial, because the social aspects of it are very, very bad. And particularly in our country, it is often the case that when those groupings are formed, it's more likely you'll look around in the low group and see that you're looking at a bunch of other black kids or Hispanic kids or immigrants. And that's particularly awful. You know, you've got an ethnically mixed school, but you've unmixed it because of the grouping strategy that you're using. That's something, again, that if you absolutely had to, it's one argument, but in general, you don't. You can deal with those differences in a different way that doesn't separate people out. Another problem, however, is that there's loads of research to indicate that people make terrible mistakes in assignments of kids. Some of those mistakes, unfortunately, are very correlated with social class or ethnicity, so that you may be placed in a low-performing group and your performance is actually quite good. But because you're placed there, you know, let's say you're placed there in fifth grade, then in sixth grade they say, well, you know, he was in the low group last year, he must be in the low group this year. And, you know, it's continued along. And I have to say, you know, as somebody who works on ability grouping, numbers of times people have told me about their own personal experiences where, for whatever reason, they were placed in the low group and continued in the low group for quite a while until somebody happened through some amazing accident to notice that they were really quite capable and changed them out of that. And now they're professors or they're, you know, they're physicians or, you know, I mean, they're very at very high levels, indicating that they obviously were always very bright, but for whatever reason, that was not recognized at a particular point and it was changing their lives. I remember particularly an African-American woman who's now a professor. She was put in the low group, she feels, mostly because she was African-American. She went to a completely black elementary school, but then she went to middle school, which was mixed, and they said, well, if she comes from that school, we're putting her in the low group, just almost automatically. I said, that must have been terrible. She said, no, it was great fun. You know, we just played all day. No, you know, nobody taught us anything. Until her mother got upset and came down to the school and said, no, that's, you know, my daughter is really very capable. I want you to test her and I want you to find, you know. And she was, okay, they put her in the high track and she stayed there, you know, for the rest of her time and did very well. But had her mother not done that, what would her future have been? And so it's just something, again, not that you could never do it, but when that kind of possibility presents itself, and it does, and when, you know, you have the problem of teachers who have very low expectations for the low groups, or, you know, where quite frequently the newest teachers, the least capable teachers are assigned to those groups and the teachers don't want to be there. You know, there's a whole lot of things that happen, particularly related to the quality of teaching in the low groups, that are just very hard to justify. It's not a gift to be placed in those groups. You know, it's not like you're going to get something wonderful that's going to then accelerate you, you know, into average achievement. Most places, unfortunately, should that take place, that's sort of a permanent identification, problem solved, rather than a temporary assistance to get you to the average of the school.
And that description of the negative effects of ability grouping from Professor Bob Slaven brings this week's Inside Education to a close. I'll bring you the second part of my interview with Bob Slaven on next week's programme. If you like what you heard today, please tell your friends about Inside Education by sharing links to the programme on social media like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and so on. You can listen to or download podcasts of over 250 previous Inside Education programmes on insideed.com. You can get in touch with me by emailing feedback or suggestions to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.